this is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Obama Justice Department has intervened yet again to help Hillary Clinton win in November. Evidently, it's not content with protecting the Democratic presidential candidate against prosecution for her compromise of classified information or the corrupt abuse of the Office of Secretary of State to enrich her family and its charitable foundation. The department just prevented the disclosure of documents that would likely have exposed Mrs. Clinton's role in the disastrous decision to overthrow Muammar Gaddafi and arm his jihadist opponents. As a result, years of politically motivated prosecution of Mark Turi, a man wrongly accused of gun-running to Libya, has come to an abrupt end. That's good news for Mr. Turi. It's bad news for voters who will shortly have to evaluate the fitness of a potential commander-in-chief on the basis of spin rather than her actual record of malfeasance. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back for the third segment of this important conversation with an extraordinarily informed and thoughtful observer of the nature and menace of Islamic totalitarianism. He is Ilan Jorno with the Ayn Rand Institute. We're talking a bit about his newest book, Failing to Confront Islamic Totalitarianism, but also drawing upon some of the insights in an important companion piece that he wrote in 2009, edited in 2009, entitled Winning the Unwinnable War, America's Self-Crippled Response to Islamic Totalitarianism. Ilan, I want to really walk through a facet of this larger problem that is almost entirely unremarked. I mean, you get it, I think, and have helped shed light on it. But, for example, in the course of the conversation last night between Senator Tim Kaine and Governor Mike Pence, the vice presidential candidates, respectively, for the Democrats and the Republican Party, there was nary a mention of the problem of the Muslim Brotherhood. And I would just ask you to talk a little bit about this group, what it represents in terms of this, you know, sort of global totalitarian jihadist movement, including in our own country.
So the Muslim Brotherhood is probably one of the oldest Islamic totalitarian movements, organizations that we know of. It started in the 1920s in Egypt, as some of your listeners well know, I think. And it was a really powerful movement in the sense, not that it achieved any of its immediate goals in the first 90 years or so of its existence. But I think they came close in Egypt after the Arab Spring. But in that it was an intellectual fount, and many groups spun off from it. And it managed to build a network throughout the Middle East of chapters, some of which we know today because they've become very, very powerful and dangerous. So Hamas was a spinoff from the Muslim Brotherhood chapter in the Palestinian territories. One of the groups that is also notorious is some of the groups that formed Al-Qaeda originated as parts of the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, it's important to see that the spinoffs were often by people who felt that the Muslim Brotherhood's agenda was too slow, it was too incremental, it was too focused on cultural change for the long term because they played the long game. And the people who spun off basically said, well, we need to be more active. Look at what they managed to do in 1979 in Iran. The fighters for jihad succeeded in overtaking that country. We need to act and act now. And there's that kind of spirit of activism and the need to take up arms sooner rather than later. And that's important to see that it's, we need to take violence to the streets at some point. But when are we ready?
How has that translated in practice, that kind of jihad? I think they call it civilization jihad in countries in the West, including our own.
So I think the best model to look at, and I think what they hope to replicate, is what they did in Egypt and elsewhere, and then I'll talk about the West. So it was essentially cultivating a group of people, a culture or a subgroup, and then widely the whole culture so that people accept the ideas in their own lives through indoctrination and education and just acculturation, so that by the time there's a need to call a revolution or to seal the deal, in effect, most people in the culture are ready for it. Now, I understand that this has not been a focus of my research, that part of their goal is to do that beyond where they have chapters and perhaps even in the West, and to kind of infiltrate and do subversion and so forth. Maybe this is a field you know more about, but I understand that, and I wouldn't discount it. I think it's important to understand that the only way that can succeed fundamentally is not because they're wily, but because we aren't paying attention and we aren't scrutinizing the people that we're holding up as experts on Islam acting. So there are all kinds of stories of the last 15 years of advisors and trainers to the FBI and the CIA who in effect are put up as, well, these guys are normal, great people. They're on our side. They're helping. But in fact, if you look at their statements and their actions, they're very sympathetic to the enemy. And that's a problem, though. To me, it's startling that they can gain authority and positions of training and instructorship of law enforcement and yet be so sympathetic to the enemy. So to me, that's another telling sign of how little we understand them, and not just their tactics and the idea that they can subvert from it within, but just the very idea of, well, how do you know if someone's on your side? How do you know what their stand is? And to me, that's significant.
It is enormously significant. And in fact, Ilan Giorno, this is a subject that the Center for Security Policy has focused a lot of time and effort on. In fact, we have an entire series of monographs that we've published, which I commend to you as well as to our listeners. They're available for free online as PDFs at securefreedom.org. We call them the Civilization Jihad Reader Series, a name that derives from this extraordinary book I'm sure you're familiar with called The Explanatory Memorandum, a secret plan that the U.S. government introduced in evidence in the Holy Land Foundation trial, the largest terrorism financing trial in U.S. history back in 2008, and used it to convict people associated with the Muslim Brotherhood, and I think setting the stage for prosecuting a whole bunch more. Alas, that didn't happen. For reasons, among others, that you've sort of alluded to, the extent to which we've taken counsel and guidance about what we can know and see and do about all of this from people who are, in fact, Muslim Brotherhood operatives or at least aligned with them. I guess this is really the crux of the matter. One of the things that, as you know, has been very much a feature of the Islamist agenda has been to prevent what they call Sharia blasphemy, which would be things, expression, videos, speeches, written articles, what have you. I dare say your books and writings, most certainly, that offend Muslims. And I just ask you to talk a little bit about if indeed, as you say, we've had a failure under successive administrations, Republican and Democratic, to understand, let alone effectively to confront Islamic totalitarianism, whether that silencing of us in the name of, avoiding giving offense might be a contributing factor.
It is a huge factor. I think it's way understated, and people don't really appreciate what we're facing here with the attacks on free speech, because they're just the tip of the spear for what I regard as the essential agenda, which is people recall the cartoon crisis of 2005-2006 with Danish cartoons and the uproar that caused, and one of the publications that reprinted those cartoons was Charlie Hebdo, and of course in 2015 the editorial offices of Charlie Hebdo were attacked and the editorial staff massacred. What people don't understand is that this isn't about offense. This is about elevating their perspective on the world, their Islamic totalitarian agenda, and saying, no, you mustn't live according to the principle of free speech, which means that every ideology is subject to criticism and ridicule, and you might not like that. You have to live with it. That's what a free society looks like. No, you mustn't live by that principle. You must live by a higher principle. That means the doctrines of Sharia, which say blasphemy is bad. And blasphemy, by the way, as it was in the medieval times in Europe under the church and today, is a subjective term. What does it really mean to blaspheme except to offend the people in power who want to subjugate you? So the attacks on free speech, which are significant, are part of this idea that we have to elevate certain religious dicta above the Constitution, above the First Amendment, above free speech as a principle, a moral principle. And what I would highlight here is that this has succeeded in the examples we've seen lately, and the cartoon crisis from about 10 years ago, and even before that with the fatwa on the life of the author Salman Rushdie. These only succeed because we in the West have crumpled. We have not stood up for our own principles, and that has only encouraged them.
We have to pause for another moment, and when we come back, I want to talk about that that phenomenon, why we're doing it, and what it's signaling to our adversaries in the Islamic totalitarian or global jihadist movement. That and more with the Lawn Journal, straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.